recovered his jug and went into the house. He found Sigani sitting at the table, a dagger before her. Her hair was unwashed, her face drawn, her eyes tired. Gwalch gathered two clay cups and filled them both with mead, pushing one towards her. She shook her head.
"Drink it, girl,"
he said, sitting opposite her.
"It'll do you no harm."
"Read my mind," she commanded.
"Nope. You'll remember when you're ready."
"Damn you, Gwalch, you're quick to tell everyone's fortune but mine. What happened the night when my parents were butchered? Tell me."
"You know what happened. Your father and his wife were killed. You survived. What else is there to know?"
"Why did my hair turn white? Why were the bodies buried so swiftly? I didn't even see them."
"Tell me about last night."
"Why should I? You already know. Bernd's ghost came to me at the pool."
"Nope," he said. "That wasn't Bernd. Poor, sad Bernd is gone from the world. The spirit who spoke to you was from another time. Why did you run?"
"I was frightened." Her pale eyes looked to his, daring him to criticize her. Gwalt smiled.
"Not easy to admit, is it? Not when you're a Sigarni, the huntress, the woman who needs no one. Did you know this is my birthday? 78 years ago today I made my first cry. Killed my first man 14 years later. A cattle raider. Tracked him for 3 days. He took my father's prize bull. It's been a long life, Sigarni. Long and irritatingly eventful."
Pouring the last of the mead, he drained it in a single swallow, then gazed longingly at the empty jug. "Who was the ghost?" she asked.
"Go and ask him, woman. Call for him."
She shivered and looked away. "I can't." Gwalch chuckled.
"There is nothing you cannot do, Sigarni. Nothing."
Reaching across the table, she took his hand, stroking it tenderly.
"Oh, come on, Gwalch, are we not friends? Why won't you help me?"
"I am helping you. I am giving you good advice. You don't remember the night of the slaughter. You will, when the time is right. I helped take the memory from you when I found you by the pool. Madness had come upon you, girl. You were sitting in a puddle of your own urine. Your eyes were blank and you were slack-jawed. I had a friend with me. His name was Taliesin. It was he and another who slew the slaughterers. Taliesin told me we were going to lock away the memory and bring you back to the world of the living. We did exactly that. The door will open one day when you're strong enough to turn the key. That's what he told me."
"So," she said, snatching back her hand, "your only advice is for me to return to the pool and face the ghost, yes?"
"Yes,"
he agreed. "Well, I won't do it."
"That is your choice, Sigarni, and perhaps it is the right one. Time will show. Are you angry with me?"
"Yes."
"Are you angry to fetch me the flagon of honeymead you have in the kitchen?"
Sigarni smiled then and fetched the flagon. "You are an old reprobate, and I don't know why you've lived so long. I think maybe you're just too stubborn to die." Leaning forward, she proffered the flagon, but as he reached for it, she drew it back. "One question you must answer. The slaughterers were not human, were they?" He licked his lips, but his eyes remained fixed on the flagon. "Were they?" she persisted.
"Nope,"
he admitted.
"They were birthed in the dark, hollow tooths sent to kill you."
"Why me?"
"You said one question,"
he reminded her.
"But I'll answer it. They came for you because of who you are. That is all I will say now. But I promise you, we will speak again soon."
She handed him the flagon and sat down.
"I cannot go to the pool, Gwal. I cannot."
Gwalch Mai did not answer her. The mead was beginning to work its magic, and his mind swam. The Baron Ranulf Gotterson ran a bony finger down the line of the map.
"And this represents what?"
he asked the blonde young man shivering before him. Leofric rubbed his cold hands together, thankful that he had had the common sense to wear a woolen undershirt below his tunic and two pairs of thick socks. His fleece-lined gloves were in his pocket, and he wished he had the nerve to wear them. The Baron's study at the top of the citadel was always cold, though a fire was permanently laid, as if to mock the Baron's servants.
"Are you listening, boy?"
snarled the Baron. Leofric leaned over the table and felt the cold breeze from the open window flicker against his back.
"That is the River Dranuin, sir. It starts on the northern flank of Hydroin and meanders through the forest into the sea. That is in Palladies lands."
The Baron glanced up and smiled. The boy's face was blue-tinged.
"Cold, Leofric?"
"Yes, sir. A soldier learns to put aside thoughts of discomfort. Now, tell me about the Palladies." "I am not a soldier," thought Leofric. "I am a cleric, and there is a difference between the discomfort endured through necessity and the active enjoyment of it."
But these thoughts he kept to himself.
"The largest of the clans, the Palladies, number some 6,000 people. It used to be more, but the Great War devastated them. In the main, they are cattle breeders, though there are some farms which grow oats and barley. In the far north, there are two main fishing fleets. The Palladies are spread over some 200 square miles and live in 16 villages, the largest being Caswallir, named after a warrior of old who, legend claims, brought the Witch Queen to their aid in the Aenir Wars."
"I don't care about legends, just facts. How many people in Caswallir?"
"Around 1,100, sir, but it does depend on the time of year. They have their games in the autumn, and there could be as many as 5,000 people attending every day for 10 days. Of course, these are not all Palladies. Loda, Farlane, and even some Wingoras will attend, though the Wingoras are all but finished now. Our census shows only around 140 remain in the remote highlands."
"How many fighting men?"
"Just the Palladies, sir?"
asked Leofric, sitting down and opening a heavy leather-bound ledger. The Baron nodded.
"It is difficult to estimate, sir, after all. What constitutes a fighting man in a people with no army? If we are talking men and older boys capable of bearing arms, then the figure would be..."
He flicked through three pages, making swift mental calculations, then went on,
"say, 1,800? But of these, around 1,000 would be below the age of 17. Hardly veterans."
"Who leads them?"
"Well, sir, as you know, there is no longer an official Hunt Lord, but our spies tell us that the people still revere Fionn Sharpaxe and treat him as if he still held the title."
Lifting a quill pen, the Baron dipped the sharpened nib into a pot of ink and scrawled the name on a single sheet of paper.
"Go on."
"What else can I tell you, sir?"
asked Leofric, nonplussed.
"Who else do they revere?"
I don't have information on that, sir. Merely statistics."
The Baron's hooded eyes focused on the younger man's face.
"Find out, Leofric. All possible leaders, names, directions to their homes or farms."
"Might I ask, sir, why we are gathering this information? All our agents assure us there is no hint of rebellion in the Highlands. They do not have the men, the weapons, the training, or other leaders."
"Now, tell me about the other clans,"
said the Baron, his quill at the ready. Balistar sat perched on the saddle of the small grey pony and stared around at the village of Kilfallon. Despite his fears, he gazed with a sense of wonder at this unfamiliar view. The pony was only 10 hands high, barrel-bellied with short, stubby legs. A dwarf horse for a dwarf. And yet Balistar estimated he was now viewing the world from around 6 feet high, seeing it as Fel or Sigarni would see it. Fat Tovi emerged from his bakery and smiled at the dwarf.
"What nonsense is this?"
he asked, transferring his gaze to the man on the black gelding, who was waiting patiently beyond Balistar.
"The sorcerer Asmodeer has asked me to cook for him," said Balistar boldly, though even the word sent a flicker of fear through him. "And he's given me this pony for my own."
"It suits you," said Tovi. "It looks more like a large dog."
Grain the smith wandered over.
"She's a fine beast," he said, stroking his thick white beard. "In years gone by, the lowland chariots were drawn by such as she. Tough breed."
"She's mine," said Balistar, grinning. "We must leave," said the man on the black gelding, his voice deep. "The master is waiting."
Balistar tugged on the reins and tried to heel the pony forward, but his legs were so short that his feet did not extend past the saddle, and the pony stood still. Grain chuckled and walked back to his forge, returning with a slender riding crop.
"Give her just a touch with this," he said,
"not too hard, mind, and accompany it with a word or sound of command." Balistar took the leather crop.
"Giddy up!" he shouted,
swiping the crop against the pony's rear. The little animal reared and sprinted, and Balistar tumbled backwards in a somersault. Grain stepped forward and caught the dwarf, then both fell to the ground. Balistar, his bearded face crimson, struggled to his feet as Asmodeer's servant rode after the pony and led her back. Tovi was beside himself with mirth, the booming sound of his laughter echoing through the village.
"Thank you, Grain," said Balistar, with as much dignity as he could muster.
The smith pushed himself to his feet and dusted himself down.
"Think nothing of it," he said.
"Come, try again."
Pushing his huge hands under Balistar's armpits, he hoisted the dwarf to the saddle. "You'll get the hang of it soon enough. Now, be off with you."
"Giddy up," said Balistar more softly.
The pony moved forward, and Balistar lurched to the left, but clung on to the pommel and righted himself. With the village behind them, Balistar's fear returned. He had been sitting quietly behind the tavern when the dark-skinned servant found him. Had he been asked beforehand whether he would be interested in a journey to the wizard's castle, Balistar would have answered with a curt shake of his head. But 2 gold pieces and a pony had changed his mind.
2 gold pieces!
More money than Balistar had ever held. Enough to buy the little shack instead of paying rent. More than enough to have the cobbler make him a new pair of boots.
"If he doesn't sacrifice you to the demons."
Balistar shivered. Glancing up at the man on the tall horse, he gave a nervous smile, but the man did not respond.
"Have you served your master long?"
he inquired, trying to start a conversation.
"Yes."
And that was it. The man touched heels to the gelding and moved ahead, Balistar meekly following. They rode for more than an hour, moving through the trees and over the high hills. Towards mid-morning, Balistar saw Fel and 2 of his foresters, Gwyn Darkeye and Bacris Toothgone. He waved and called out to them. The 3 foresters converged on the dwarf, ignoring the dark-skinned rider.
"Good day to you, Fel," said Balistar.
Fel grinned, and Balistar experienced renewed pleasure in the fact that he could look the handsome forester straight in the eye.
"Good day to you, little friend. She's a fine pony. She's mine, a gift from the sorcerer."
"He is not a sorcerer," snapped the servant, "and I wish you would stop saying it."
"The black man wants me to cook for him. Duck. Sigarni told him about me. He's paid me with this pony."
Balistar decided not to mention the gold pieces. Fel he liked above all men, and Gwyn Darkeye had always been kind to him, but Bacris Toothgone was not a man Balistar trusted.
"Are you sure he doesn't want to cook you?"
asked Gwyn. A slightly smaller man than Fel and round-shouldered, Gwyn was the finest archer among the loader. Balistar looked down upon him and noticed the man had a bald spot beginning at his crown.
On a day like today, the thought does not concern me, said Ballister happily. Today I have seen the world as a tall man.
Enjoy it, sneered Bacchus, because when you get off that midget horse, you'll return to the useless lump you've always been.
The words were harshly spoken, and they cut through Ballister's good humour. Fell swung angrily on the forester, but before he could speak, Ballister cut in.
Don't worry about it, Fell. He's only angry because I've got a bigger prick than him. I don't know why it should concern him. Everyone else has, too.
Bacchus lunged at the dwarf, but Fell caught him by the shoulder of his leather jerkin and dragged him back.
That's enough, roared Fell.
The sudden commotion caused the pony to move forward. Asmodeus' servant nudged his gelding alongside, and the two riders continued on their way. Ballister swung in the saddle and looked back at the foresters. When he saw Bacchus staring after him, he lifted his fist and waggled his little finger. Asmodeus' servant chuckled.
You shouldn't be so swift to make enemies, he observed.
I don't care, said Ballister. And why is it that you Highlanders value so much the size of the male organ? Size is of no relevance. Not to the act itself, nor to the pleasure derived.
Ballister glanced up at the man.
Ah, he thought, so you've got a small one too.
Aloud, he said,
I wouldn't know. I have never had a woman.
It was mid-afternoon when they topped the last rise before the castle. Ballister had never travelled this far before, and he halted his pony to stare down at the magnificent building. It was not a castle in the true sense, for it was indefensible, having wide-open gateways with no gates and no moat surrounding it. It had once been the house of the Hunt Lord of the Grigors, but the clan had been annihilated in the Lowland Wars, the few survivors becoming part of the Loda. A three-storied building, with a single tower by the north wall that rose to five stories, it was built of grey granite, and the windows were of coloured glass joined by lead strips.
"We are late," said the servant. "Come!"
Ballister's heart was pounding, and his hands trembled as he flapped the reins against the pony's neck. Two gold pieces seemed a tiny amount just then. Chapter 4 Autumn was not far off, but here in the highlands even the last days of summer were touched by a bitter cold that warned of the terrible winters that lay ahead. Two fires blazed at either end of the long hall, and even the heavy velvet curtains shimmered against the cold fingers of the biting wind that sought out the cracks and gaps in the old window frames. Asmodeus pushed away his empty plate and leaned back in his chair.
"You are a fine cook," he told the dwarf.
Two servants entered, lighting lanterns that hung in iron brackets on the walls, and the hall was filled with a soft glow.
"Can I go now?"
asked Ballister. The little man was sitting at the table on a chair set upon blocks of wood.
"My dear fellow, of course you can go. But it is already becoming dark, and your pony is bedded down for the night in a comfortable stall. I have had a room prepared for you. There is a warm fire there and a soft bed. Tomorrow one of my servants will cook you a breakfast and saddle your pony. How does that sound?"
"That is wondrous kind," said Ballister, uneasily. "But I would like to be on my way."
"You fear me?"
asked Asmodeus mildly.
"A little," admitted the dwarf.
"You think me a sorcerer. Yes, I know. Sigarni told me. But I am not, Ballister. I am merely a man. Oh, I know a few spells. In Kushir, all the children of the rich are taught to make fire from air, and some can even shape dancing figures from the flames. I am not one of those. I was a nobleman, a warrior. Now I am a Highlander, albeit somewhat more dusky than most, and I would be your friend. I do not harm my friends, nor do I lie. Do you believe me?"
"What does it matter whether I believe you or not?" countered the dwarf. "You will do as you wish."
"It matters to me," said Asmodeus. "In Kushir, it was considered unacceptable for noblemen to lie. It was one of the reasons the Outlanders, as you call them, defeated the armies of the Kushir king. The Outlanders kept lying. They signed treaties they had no intention of honoring, made peace, then invaded. They used spies and agents, filling Kushir soldiers with fear and trembling. An appalling enemy, with no sense of honor.
But you fought alongside them, said Ballister.
Yes. It is a source of endless regret. Come, sit by the fire, and we shall talk.
The black man rose and walked to the fireside, settling his long frame into a deep armchair of burnished leather. A servant appeared and drew back Ballister's seat, allowing the little man to slide from his cushions to the floor. Asmodee watched as he climbed with difficulty into the opposite armchair. Then, waving away the servant, he leaned forward.
You treat your affliction with great courage, Ballister. I respect that. Now, what shall we speak of?
You could tell me why you served the Outlanders, said the dwarf.
Swift and to the point,
observed Asmodee with an easy grin.
It all came down to politics. My family were accused of treason by the Kushir king. He was hunting us down at the time the Outlanders invaded. My sister and my wife were executed by him. My father blinded and thrown into a dungeon. We have a saying in Kushir, the enemy of my enemy must therefore be my friend. So, I joined with the Outlanders.
And now you regret it?
Of course. There is no genuine satisfaction in revenge, Ballister. All a man unleashes is a beast which will destroy even those he loves. Cities were laid waste, the people slaughtered or sold into slavery. A rich, cultured nation was set back 200 years, and even when they had won, the slaughter continued. The Outlanders are a barbaric people, with no understanding of the simplest economic realities. The Kushir was rich because of trade and commerce. The lines of trade were severed and treaties with friendly nations broken. There was a great library, a Koshantin, the capital. The Outlanders burned it down.
Asmodee sighed and lifted an iron poker, idly stabbing at the burning logs.
You grew to hate them? Oh, yes. Hatred as strong and tall as high druin. But two men, more than any other, the Baron Ranulf and the Earl of Yastai. The king himself is merely a merciless savage, holding power through ruthlessness and manipulation. The Baron and the Earl hold the balance of his power.
Why are you telling me this? Asked Ballister. It is not wise. Asmodee smiled.
It is a question of judgment, my friend. Do you trust Sigourney?
In what way?
Her instincts, her values, her courage, whatever.
She is intelligent and does not suffer fools. What has this to do with anything?
She trusts you, Ballister. Therefore, so do I. And as for the risk, well, all life is a risk, and time is running too short for me to remain conservative in my plans. Sigourney tells me you are a great storyteller and somewhat of a historian. Tell me of the clans. Where are they from? How did they come here? Who are their heroes and why? What are their noble lines?
You're moving too fast for me, said Ballister. A moment ago we were talking of trust before that revenge. Now you want a story. Tell me first your purpose.
A clear thinker. I like that. Very well. First I shall tell you a story.
Asmodee clapped his hands, and a servant came forward bearing a tray on which were two golden goblets filled with fine red wine. Ballister accepted the first, holding it carefully in both hands. As the servant departed, Asmodee sipped his drink, then set the goblet aside. Leaning back, he rested his head on the high back of the chair.
With Kushir in ruins, I went home to my palace. An old man, dressed in a cloak of feathers, was waiting for me there. His face was seamed with wrinkles and lines, his hair and beard so thin they appeared to be fashioned from the memory of wood smoke. He was sitting on the steps before my door. A servant told me he had arrived an hour before and refused to be moved. They tried to lay hands upon him but could not approach him. Knowing him to be a wizard, they withdrew. I approached him and asked what he wanted. He stood and walked towards my home. The door opened for him, though there were no servants close, and he made his way to my study. Once there, he asked me what I felt about the destruction of my land and my part in it. I did not answer him, for my shame was too great. He said nothing for a moment. Then he bade me sit and began to talk of history. It was fascinating, Ballistar. It was as if he had witnessed all the events himself. Perhaps he had, I don't know. He spoke of the growth of evil and how, like a plague, it spreads and destroys. It was vital, he said, that there should always be adequate counterbalances against the forces of wickedness. Yet, he insisted, we had reached a period of history when there was no balance. The Outlanders and their allies were conquering all in their path, and those nations still resisting the advance of the Outlanders were doomed, for there were no great leaders among them. Then he told me of a conquered nation and a commander yet to come. He said, and I believed him utterly, that here, in the north, I would find a prince of destiny, and from the ashes of Highland dreams would come a dynasty that would light our way forward into a better future. I came here with high hopes, Ballistar, and yet what do I find? There is no leader, there is no army, and in the spring the Outlanders will come here with fire and sword and exterminate hundreds, perhaps thousands of peaceful farmers, cattlemen, and villagers.
As Medea threw a dry log to the dying blaze,
I do not believe that the Ancient One lied to me, and I cannot accept that he might have been mistaken. Somewhere in these lands, there is a man born to be king. I must find him before midwinter.
Ballistar drained his wine. It was rich and heavy, and he felt his head swimming.
And you think my stories might help you?
He asked.
They might provide me with a clue.
I don't see how. Legend has it that our ancestors passed through a magic gateway, but I suspect our history is no different from other migrating peoples. They probably came from a land across the water, originally as raiders. Some of our people then grew to love the mountains and sent back ships for their families. For centuries, the clans warred upon one another, but then another migrating group arrived. They were called the Anir, ancestors of the Outlanders. There was a great war. After that, the clans formed a loose-knit confederacy.
But you had kings. From where did they come?
The first true king was Sorain, known as Ironhand. He was from the Wingarath, a mighty warrior. Hundreds of years ago, he led the clans against the three armies and destroyed them. Even the lowland clans respected him, for he risked everything to free their towns. He vanished one day, but legend has it he will return when needed.
Asmodeus shook his head.
I doubt that. Every nation I know of has a hero of myth, pledged to return. None of them do. Did he have heirs?
No. He had a child, but the babe disappeared, probably murdered and buried in the woods.
So what of the other kings?
Inquired Asmodeus.
There was Gandarin, also known as the Crimson, another great warrior and statesman. He died too soon, and his sons fought among themselves for the crown. Then the Outlanders invaded, and the clans put on their red cloaks of war and were cut down on Caldon Moor. That was years ago. The young king fled over the water, but he was murdered there. Anyone known to share the blood of Gandarin was also put to the sword, and the wearing of the crimson was banned. No Highlander can have even a scarf of that colour,
And there is no one left of his line?
As far as I know, there is only Sigarni, and she is barren.
Asmodeus rubbed his tired eyes and tried to disguise the dejection he felt.
"There must be somewhere,"
he whispered,
"and he will need me. The Ancient One made that clear to me."
"He could have been wrong," volunteered Balistar. "Even Gwalsh is wrong sometimes."
"Gwalsh?"
"The clan gifted one. He used to be a warrior, but he was wounded in the head, and after that he became a prophet of sorts. People tend to avoid him. His visions are all doom-filled and gloomy. Maybe that's why he drinks so much."
Asmodeus' spirits lifted.
"Tell me, where to find him?"
he said. Sigarni was angry with herself. 4 times that morning she had flown Abby, and 4 times the Red Hawk had missed the kill. Abby was a little overweight, for there had been 3 days of solid rain and she had not flown. But even so she was acting sluggishly, and the tourney was only 2 weeks away. Sigarni was angry because she didn't know what to do, and was loath to ask Asmodeus. Could Abby be ill? She didn't think so, for the bird was flying beautifully, folding her wings and diving, swooping, turning. Only at the point of the kill did she fail. The pattern with the Red Hawk was always the same. Swoop over the hare, flick her talons, tumbling the prey, then fastening to it. Sigarni would run forward, covering the hare with her glove, then casting a piece of meat some distance from the hawk. The bird would glance at the titbit, then leave the gloved hare to be killed and bagged by Sigarni. But not today. Sigarni lifted her arm and whistled for Abby. The hawk dived obediently from the high branch and landed on the outstretched fist, her cruel beak fastening to the tiny amount of meat Sigarni held between her fingers.
"What's wrong with you, Abby?"
whispered Sigarni, stroking the bird's breast with a long pigeon feather.
"Are you sick?"
The golden eyes, bright and impenetrable, looked into her own. Returning to the cabin, Sigarni did not take Abby to her bow perch, but carried her inside and sat her on the high back of a wooden chair. The cabin was cold, and Sigarni lit a fire, banking up the logs and adding 2 large lumps of coal from the sack given to her by Asmodeus. From the cupboard, she took her scales, hooking them to a broad beam across the centre of the cabin. Fetching Abby, she weighed her. 2 pounds 7 ounces, 5 ounces above her perfect killing weight.
"What am I to do with you, beauty?"
she asked softly, stroking the bird's head and neck.
"To keep you obedient, I must feed you. Yet if you do not fly, you get fat and lazy and are useless to me. If I starve you, all your training will disappear, and I will be forced to start again as if it never was. Yet you are intelligent, I know this. Is your memory so short? Hmm? Is that it, Abby?"
Sigarni sighed. Taking the hawk's hood from the pouch at her belt, she stroked it into place. Abby sat quietly, blind now but trusting. Sigarni sat by the fire, tired and listless. Lady scratched at the door, and Sigarni opened it, allowing the hound to pad inside and stretch her lean black frame in front of the fire.
"I hope you've already eaten," she told the hound, "since we've caught nothing today."
Lady's tail beat against the floor, and she tilted back her head, looking at Sigarni through 1 huge brown eye.
"Yes," said the woman. "I don't doubt you have. You're the best hare-hound in the Highlands. You know that, don't you? Faster than the wind, though not as fast as Abby."
The darkness was growing outside, and Sigarni lit a small lamp which she hung over the fireplace. Stretching out her legs, she removed her wet doeskin boots and her oiled leather trews. The warm air from the fire touched the bare skin of her legs, and she shivered with pleasure.
"If only I wasn't hungry," she said aloud, stripping off her buckskin shirt and tossing it to the floor.
The fire crackled and grew, casting dancing shadows on the walls of the cabin.
"I have the bells of hell clanging in my head," said Gwalch, walking from the bedroom, clutching his temples.
"Then you shouldn't drink so much, Gwal,"
she said with a smile.
All right for you, but I...
He stopped as he saw her nakedness.
Jerker's balls, woman! That's not decent!
You said you'd be gone, old fool. It would be decent enough were I alone.
Ah, well,
he said with a broad grin.
I think I might as well make the best of it.
Pulling up a chair, he gazed with honest admiration at her firelit form.
Wonderful creatures, woman, he said. If God ever made anything more beautiful, he has never shown it to me.
Since your eyes are standing now on reed stalks, I take it that you are a breast man, she said with a laugh. Now, Phil is a legs and hips man. His eyes are naturally drawn to a woman's buttocks. Strange beasts, men. If God ever made anything more ludicrous, she's never shown it to me.
Gwalch leaned back and roared with laughter.
Blasphemy and indecency in the same breath. By heaven, Sigourney, there's no one like you. Now, for the sake of an old man's feelings, will you cover yourself?
Feel the blood rising, old man?
No, and that is depressing. Dress for me, child, there's a good girl.
Sigourney did not argue, but slipped a buckskin shirt over her head. It was almost as long as a tunic, and covered her to her thighs.
Is that better, Gwal? You weren't so worried when I lived with you, and you bathed me and washed my hair.
You were a child and titless, and you were hurt, lass.
How'd you kill a demon, Gwal?
She asked softly. He scratched at the white stubble on his chin.
Is there no food in this house? My God, a man could die of starvation visiting you.
There's a little cold stew, and a spare flagon of your honey spirit. It's too fiery for my taste. You want that, or shall I heat up the stew?
He gave a wicked grin and winked.
No, lass, just fetch me a drop of the honeydew.
First, a bargain.
No,
he said, his voice firm.
I will tell you no more, not yet, and if that means a dry night, then so be it.
When will you tell me?
Soon. Trust me.
Of all men, I trust you most, she said, moving forward to kiss his brow.
She fetched him the flagon and watched as he filled a clay cup. The liquid was thin and golden and touched the throat like a flame.
Gwalt drained the cup and leaned back with a sigh. Enough of this, and a man would live forever, he said.
She shook her head.
You are incorrigible. Do you know the legend of Iron Hand?
Of course, went through a gateway to return when we need him.
And will he return?
Yes, when the time is right.
He drank a second cup.
That's not true, Gwalch. I found his bones.
Yes, I know. Under several boulders in the pool of the falls. Why did you tell no one?
Sigourney was surprised, though instantly she knew she should not have been.
Why do you ask when you already know the answer?
She countered.
It is not polite to answer a question with a question, girl. You know that.
People need legends, she told him.
Who am I to rob them of their power?
He was a great man, and it is nice for people to think he actually managed to kill all the assassins, instead of being done to death by the murdering scum.
Oh, but he did kill them all. 7 of them. And him, wounded unto death. Killed them and their warhounds. Then he sat by the pool, his strength fading. He was found by one of his retainers, a trusted man, loyal and steadfast. Iron Hand told him to hide his body where none could find it until the chosen time. You see, he had the gift. It came on him as he was dying. So the word went out that Iron Hand had crossed the gateway and would one day return. And so it will be.
Gwalch filled a third cup and half drank it. Leaning forward, he placed the cup on the hearthstone, then sank back, his breathing deepening.
When will he come back, Gwalch?
Whispered Sigourney.
He already has, once,
answered the old man, his voice slurring.
On the night of the slaughter. It was he who killed the last demon.
The old man began to snore gently. Fel loved the mountains. The high, lonely passes, the stands of pine and the sloping valleys, the snow-crowned peaks and the vast sweep of this harsh country. He stood now above the snow line on Hydruin, staring out to the north, the lands of the Pallades, and further to the distant shimmering river that separated the Pallades clan from the quiet, grim men of the Farlan. This was a land that demanded much more from a man. Farming was not easy here, for the winters were harsh beyond compare, the summers often wet and miserable, drowning the roots of most crops, bar oats, which seemed to thrive in the highlands. Cattle were bred in the valleys, hard, tough, long-haired beasts with horns sweeping out sharp as needles. Those horns needed to be sharp when the wolves came or the black bears. And despite the long hair and the sturdiness of their powerful bodies, the vicious winters claimed a large percentage of the beasts, trapped in snowdrifts or killed in falls from the icy ridges and steep rises. It was no land for the weak of spirit or the soft of body. The cool dusk breeze brushed the skin of his face, and he rubbed his chin. Soon he would let his close-cropped beard grow long, protecting his face and neck from the bitter bite of the winter winds. Fel climbed on, traversing a treacherous ridge and climbing down towards the supply cave. He reached it just before nightfall. The flap which covered the narrow opening was rotting, and he made a mental note to bring a new spread of canvas on his next visit. It wasn't much of a barrier, but it kept stray animals from using the cave as shelter, and on a cold night it helped to hold in the heat from the fire. The cave was deep, but narrow, and a rough-built hearth had been built some 10 feet from the back wall below a natural chimney that filtered smoke up through the mountain. As was usual, the fire was laid ready for a traveller, with 2 flint rocks laid beside it. By the far wall was enough wood to keep a blaze burning for several nights. There was also a store cupboard containing oats and honey, and a small pot of salted beef. Alongside this were 12 wax candles. It was one of Fel's favourite places. Here, sitting quietly without interruption, he could think or dream. Mostly he thought about his role as captain of the foresters, how best to patrol the forest and valleys, to cull the deer herds and hunt the wolves. Tonight he wanted to dream, to sit idly in the cave and settle his spirit. Swiftly he lit a fire, then removed his cloak and pack, and stood his longbow and quiver against the wall. From the pack he pulled a small pot and a sack of oats. When the fire had taken, he placed the pot over it and made several trips outside, returning with handfuls of snow which he dropped into the pot. At last, when there was enough water, he added oats and a pinch of salt, stirring the contents with a wooden spoon. Fel preferred his porridge with honey, but he had brought none with him and was loath to raid the store. A man could never tell when he would need the provisions in the small store cupboard, and Fel did not want to be stuck on Hydruin in the depths of winter, only to remember that on a calm night in late summer he had eaten the honey on a whim. Instead, he cooked his porridge unsweetened, then put it aside to cool. Sigarni's face came unbidden to his mind, and Fel swore softly.
"I must have sons," he said aloud,
surprised how defensive the words sounded.
"A man needs love also," said a voice.
Fel's heart almost stopped beating. Leaping to his feet, he spun around. There was no one there. The forester drew his double-edged hunting knife.
"You'll have no need of that, boy,"
said the voice, this time coming from his left. Fel turned to see, sitting quietly by the fire, the oldest man he had ever seen. His face a maze of firelit wrinkles, his skin sagging grotesquely around the chin. He was wearing a tunic and leggings of green plaid, and a cloak that seemed to be fashioned from feathers of every kind, pigeon, hawk, sparrow, raven. Fel flicked a glance at the canvas flap over the doorway. It was still pegged in place.
"How did you get in here?"
he asked.
"By another doorway, Fel. Come, sit with me."
The old man stretched out a fleshless arm and gestured to the forester to join him.
Are you a ghost?
The old man thought about it.
An interesting question. I am due to die long before you were born, so in one sense I suppose I am already dead. But no, I am not a spirit. I am flesh and blood, though there is precious little flesh left. I am Taliesin, the druid.
Fel moved to the fire and squatted down opposite the old man. He seemed harmless enough and was carrying no weapon, but even so, Fel kept his dagger in his hand.
"How is it that you know me?"
he asked.
"Your father gave me bread and salt the last time I came here. 19 years ago, by your reckoning, you were 6. You looked at my face and asked why it no longer fit me."
The old man gave a dry chuckle.
"We do so love the young. Their questions are so deliciously impertinent."
"I don't remember it."
"It was the night of the twin moons. I had another man with me. He was tall and recklessly handsome, and he wore a shirt of buckskin emblazoned with a red hawk motif."
"I do remember," said Fel, surprised.
"His name was Caswallon, and he sat with me and taught me how to whistle through my teeth."
The old man's face showed a look of exasperation. He shook his head and whispered something that sounded to Fel like a curse. Then he looked up.
"It was a night when 2 moons appeared in the sky, and the gateways of time shimmered open, causing a minor earthquake and several avalanches, but you remember it because you learned to whistle." "Ah, well, such, I fear, is the way of things. You intend to share that porridge?"
"Such was not my intention," said Fel testily. "But since you remind me of my manners, I am obliged to offer you some."
"Never does a man arm to be reminded of his manners," said Taliesin.
Fel rose and fetched 2 wooden bowls from the cupboard. There was only 1 spoon, which he offered to the old man. Taliesin ate slowly, then put aside his bowl half-finished.
"I see you've lost the art of porridge in this time,"
he said.
"Still, it will suffice to put a little energy into this old frame. Now, to the matter at hand. How is Sigourney?"
"She's well, old man. How'd you know her?"
Taliesin smiled.
"I don't. Well, not exactly. My friend with a hawk shirt brought her to the people who raised her. He risked much to do so. But then, he was an incautious man, and one ruled by an iron morality. Such men are dangerous friends, but they make even more deadly enemies. Thankfully, he was always more of a friend."
"What do you mean, brought her? She lived with her father and mother until
the night of the slaughter. Yes, yes, I know. But they were not her parents. Their child died in her cot. Sigourney was a changeling. Well, that is all beside the point. I take it the invasion is not underway yet?" "No, of course it isn't. I may be getting old, but I still have a certain talent when it comes to gateways. It is now 6 days from the end of summer, yes?"
4 days.
But you make no sense, old man,"
said Fel, adding more wood to the fire. "What invasion?"
4 days. Well, close enough,"
said the old man, looking down at his gnarled hand and tapping his thumb to each of the fingers, as if working on some simple calculation. He stood and wandered to the doorway, pulling back the flap and looking up at the sky, scanning the bright stars.
"Ah, yes," he said, returning to the fire. 4 days, quite right. Now, what was your question? The invasion, where to begin? The descendants of the Anir, the conquerors of the lowlands. What do you call them? Outlanders? Yes, outlanders. They will come in the spring with fire and sword. I know you suspect this already, young Fel. Still, that is not important at this moment, for we were speaking of Sigourney. Is she strong? Is she willful and obstinate? Does she have a piercing stare that strikes fear into the hearts of strong men?
Fel laughed suddenly.
Yes, all of those.
His smile faded.
But speak plainly, old man, for I wish to hear more of this invasion you speak of. Why would they invade?
Why, indeed? What motivates the minds of evil men? Who can truly know save another evil man? Testy though I've been throughout my long life, I've never been evil, and therefore cannot answer your questions with any guarantee of accuracy. I can hazard a guess, however.
I never knew a man who could talk so long and say so little, snapped Fel.
Youth was always impatient,
Taliesin rebuked him mildly.
There are two main reasons I can think of. One concerns a prophecy being talked of in the south about a great leader who will rise among the peoples of the highlands. Prophecies of this nature are not usually welcomed by tyrants. Secondly, and probably more important, is the fact that the Baron Ranulf Gotteson is ambitious. He has two enemies. One is the king and the other is the Earl Yastai. By raising an army in the highlands, he can make himself a power again in the capital, especially with a few victories to brag of.
How can he achieve victories when there is no army to fight him?
Taliesin smiled and shook his head.
For that very reason, how can he not?
But there is no leader. God's teeth, this is insane.
Wrong again, boy. There is a leader. That is why I am here, sitting in this cold, inhospitable cave with its dull company and worse porridge. There is a leader.
Fel stared at him.
Me? You think it's me? Do I look like an idiot boy? No, Fel, you are not the leader. You're brave and intelligent, and you will be loyal.
He chuckled.
But you are not gifted to command armies. You have not the talent, nor the will, nor the blood. Thank you for your honesty, said Fel,
feeling both aggrieved and relieved.
Then who is it? You will see. In 3 days outside the walls of Citadel Town, a sword will be raised and the red will be worn again. Be there, Fel. In 3 days, at dawn, by the light of the new sun, you will see the birth of a legend.
The old man stood, and his joints cracked like dry twigs. Fel rose also.
If you are some sort of prophet, then you must know the outcome of the invasion. Will my people survive? Some will, some won't. But it is not quite so simple, young man. There's only ever one past, but myriad futures. Though sometimes the past can be another man's future. Now there's a riddle to spin your head like a top eight.
The old man's features softened.
I'm not trying to baffle you, Fel. But I have knowledge gained over 20 times your lifetime. I cannot impart it to you in the brief moment we have.
Let us
merely say that I know what should happen, and I know what could happen. I can therefore say with certainty what might happen, but never can I tell you what will happen.
Even Gwalch is more sure than that, put in Fel, and he's drunk half the time.
Some events are set in stone and a part of destiny,
agreed Taliesin,
as you will see in 3 days at Citadel Town. Others are more fluid.
He smiled.
Don't even try to make sense of what I tell you. Just be close to Citadel Town. And now, I will show you something more memorable than teeth whistling. Watch carefully, Fel, or you will not see its like again.
So saying, the man walked towards the wall and through it. Fel gasped, blinked, then pushed himself upright and ran to the wall. It was solid rock. But of the old man, there was no sign. For a moment, Fel stood there, his broad right hand resting on the rock. Then he turned and glanced back at the fire. It had died down. Adding more wood, he waited until the flames rose and flickered high, then settled down beside the fire. It was pitch dark and icy cold outside the cave now, but he felt the heat from the blaze and was comfortable. And as he dropped into a deep and dreamless sleep, He heard again the words of the old man.
Be there, Fel, in 3 days at dawn. By the light of the new sun you will see the birth of a legend.
Will Stamper moved through the market crowds, scanning for signs of cutpurses or beggars. He had been corporal of the watch for 2 years now, and the burly soldier took his job very seriously. Beside him, the shorter Ralph Witterson munched on an apple.
More people this year, said Ralph, tossing away the core.
A mangy mongrel sniffed at it, then moved away.
Population's growing,
Will told him, stroking a broad finger under the chin-strap of his iron helmet.
All them new houses on East Street are sold now. They're talking of building to the north. God knows why people want to come to this place.
You did, Ralph pointed out. Will nodded and was about to speak when he saw a small grey-haired man in a dirty brown tunic moving at the edge of the crowd. The man saw him at the same instant and swiftly darted down an alleyway.
Alan Shortblade, said Will. I'll have the old bastard one of these days. What was I saying?
Can't remember. Something about buildings going up and immigrants coming in, answered Ralph, pausing at a meat stall and helping himself to a salt beef sausage. The stallholder said nothing and looked away. Ralph bit into the sausage. Not bad, he said, but too much cereal. Shouldn't be allowed. Can't rightly call it a sausage if there's more bread than meat in it. The two moved slowly through Market Street, then down Baker's Alley, and into the main square where the tents and marquees were being erected ready for tournament day. The sound of hammers on nails filled the square as workmen continued to build the high-banked seats for the nobles and their ladies, and Will saw the slight blonde Lord Leofric directing operations. Beside him stood the captain of the watch. Will cursed softly. Ralph tapped Will's arm.
Let's go back through Market Street, he advised.
Will was about to agree when the captain saw them. With an imperious flick of his finger, he summoned them over. Will took a deep breath. He had no liking for the captain, and worse, no respect. The man was a career soldier, but he cared nothing for the well-being of his men. Redger Cushirbane, knight of the court, son of the Earl of Cordenia, did not wait for the soldiers to reach him. Arms clasped behind his back, he strode towards them, his red beard jutting.
Well, he asked, caught any cut purses?
Not yet, sir,
said Will, giving the clenched fist salute.
Nor will you if that stomach keeps spreading, man. I'll have no lard bellies under my command.
Yes, sir.
It was futile to offer any form of argument, as Will Stamper had long ago discovered to his cost. Happily for Will, the captain turned his attention to Ralph.
There's no shine to your buckle, man. Your helmet plume looks like it's been used to wipe a horse's arse. There's a 5 copper fine, and you will report to my adjutant for extra duty.
Yes, sir, said Ralph meekly.
Well, get on with your rounds,
commanded Redger, spinning on his heel, his red cloak swirling out.
What a gout brain, whispered Ralph.
Your plume looks like it's been used to wipe a horse's arse,
he mimicked.
More likely he's been used to brush his tongue after he dropped on his knees to kiss the baron's rear.
Will chuckled, and the two soldiers continued on their way through Tanner Street and back into the market.
"Wow, look at that," said Ralph, pointing.
Will saw the object of his attention and let out a low whistle. A tall woman was moving through the market, her hair shining silver despite her youth, and on her left fist sat a red hawk.
Look at the legs on that girl, Will, all the way up to the neck, and what an arse, tight, firm.
I tell you, I wouldn't crawl across her to get to you.
Bit thin for my taste,
said the older man,
but she walks well, I'll say that. She's a Highlander.
How do you know? Just because she's wearing buckskins. Lots of Lowlanders wear buckskins.
Look at the way she moves,
said Will,
proud, arrogant. Nah, Highlander. They're all like that. I see she's not wearing a marriage bangle.
As they watched, they saw the hawk suddenly bait, wings flapping in panic. The woman calmed it, gently stroking its red head.
She could stroke me like that, said Ralph. A bit lower down, though. Come on, let's talk to her.
What for? I go off duty at dusk. You never know.